Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome to the program for January 26, 2021, dedicated to commemorate International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which will be on January the 27th. On the 76th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi death camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau. My name is Walter Bingham, and today's Hebrew date is the 13th of Shvat 5781. The feature item that will take up a major part of today's double-length program is the harrowing account of the war crimes trial of the concentration camp doctors, as told by the court stenographer who saw it all. There is also a report from the first Shabbat at the concentration camp Bergen-Belsen after its liberation by British troops. It's a historic sound document. But I would be remiss not to pay tribute to Sheldon Adelson, Zichron Livracha, who died last week, aged 87, and to send my sincere condolences to his wife Miriam and family. Sheldon Adelson was a Baal Tzedakah in the fullest sense, the best known and arguably largest contributor of millions to Israeli causes. He was also a main financial backer of President Trump and his campaigns. The son of a Jewish cab driver in Boston, Massachusetts, he built a business empire mainly in casino hotels that stretched from Las Vegas to Macau and beyond. Tributes have been pouring in from all over the world, and Adelson has been buried in Israel and will be sorely missed by international Jewry. May his memory be for a blessing. I wanted to reserve my thoughts on the American political horror show for a later program, but there's one thought that I believe I should air now. When Amazon, the world's largest book distributor, first started, and when Google began as an international information source, their declared purpose was to disseminate knowledge as widely as possible and to inform on any subject. They subsequently developed into platforms that facilitate the expression of viewpoints by the general public. It was an admirable concept that allowed healthy discussion.
Israel is located in one of the most volatile areas in the world. Israel is an island of stability in a sea of war and unrest. In the midst of this turmoil, Israel stands out as a beacon of order and human progress. Each week we update you on what's happening in this, the Jewish state, a true light unto the nations. This is Jay Shapiro. Join me every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Google became a powerful tool as a search engine used by almost every internet user. Realizing their power, and that also applies to Twitter, they entered the arena of politics. But not to encourage political thought and facilitate rational argument. That would have been a most valuable service to their vast readership. But no, their idea of stimulating thought was to channel it into a narrow range that promotes a so-called socialist philosophy that ironically borders on fascism, as for instance we see from the declared policy of the American Democrat Party and their satellites like Black Lives Matter. I can see echoes of Orwell's 1984, Big Brother is watching you. Don't dare to deviate from the permitted political view. The power of these large tech companies has now reached a point where their influence is larger than that of the governments, where they can close down free speech at will, and where even heads of state can be silenced on social media. In fact, it's the tool that assists the powerful to squeeze people into conformity. To prevent the politics of the Western world from becoming the dictatorship of the tech companies, their monopolies have to be dismantled into their constituent parts. In the United States, President Trump demanded that Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996 must be revoked because it is the cause of the disproportionate power and strength held by companies like Google, Twitter, and Amazon. The Act states that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. In short, these tech companies cannot be held liable for content they publish or censor. They themselves can decide what the public should know. And now my contribution to the memory of the victims of the Holocaust for this year's International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Among the many Nazi concentration camps that were liberated just before the end of World War II was Bergen-Belsen, near Celle in the area of Hanover in Germany. It was liberated by British troops on the 15th of April 1945, but the troops were unable to rescue all the inmates. On that liberation day, the British found 10,000 unburied corpses and 40,000 sick and dying prisoners. They were abandoned by their German guards and left to die. Among the 40,000 living inmates, 28,000 died after the liberation. A few days before that, April 11th to 14th, the Nazi guards made 2,000 prisoners drag the dead into huge mass graves. And at first, after the liberation, the SS guards were made to collect and bury the bodies. But that was too slow, and eventually the British had to resort to bulldozers to push the thousands of bodies into mass graves. Patrick Gordon Walker, a BBC correspondent who entered the Bergen-Belsen camp just 5 days after its liberation, reported about the horrendous conditions he saw, where some 2,000 unburied corpses were still lying in his path. He heard the first Shabbat service held in the camp that was conducted by the late Reverend Captain Leslie Hartman, Zichron Livracha, the first Jewish chaplain who entered with the British liberating troops. At the end of the service, some 200 of the Jewish inmates gathered their strength, despite exhaustion, to sing HaTikvah, the Jewish national anthem that speaks of hope. And then Reverend Hartman called out, "Am Yisrael Chai, the children of Israel still liveth." How ironic that this service took place on the 20th of April, the birth date of the man who started it all, Hitler, Yamach Shemoy.
I have the honor to have the 93-year-old Reverend Leslie Hartman on the line from London. Welcome to the program, Reverend Hartman.
Thank you very much.
How nice to hear your voice again, and I'm proud to say that we are old acquaintances, also across the microphones in London, and old here is the operative word, I think. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling fine. Just that my hearing may be a little bit impaired.
Well, we'll deal with that. I know that the events in Bergen-Belsen happened a long time ago, but I'm sure that they are indelibly imprinted in your memory. What do you remember about the day when you entered the camp for the first time?
The very first time was shock, amazement, and the inability to know what to do to help. I only had my hands and my speech, my words, but obviously they needed so much more than that.
arrived, what was the first thing you did?
The very, very first thing I did is to talk. I don't know whether I can say this to you, but I'm not being political now when I say this. As I saw the hundreds of thousands of them dead and probably several dying, I recall a speech that the late Zaev Jabotinsky made in 1938 before the war. And he said to the masses of the people he was addressing, dump the Jews of Poland on the shores of Palestine before it is too late. And I objected to the word dumping. You don't dump human beings. You dump stinking garbage and that sort of thing. Anyhow, he repeated it, and he got one of his men who was sitting on the platform to talk to me afterwards. Anyhow, when I saw what I did see in Belsen, his words came back to me.
You were in British uniform.
Oh, yes.
So, to the survivors, you looked like any other British officer. How did you make...
except with the Magin David on my lapel.
But how did you make yourself known, and what happened when you did?
I walked in, and there was a lady walking aimlessly. She was smelling. She looked ghastly. Her body was emaciated. And she saw that I was Jewish when she saw the Magen David on my uniform. And I tried to step backwards. And she thought I was going away from her. And she said, "Verlass mich, don't leave me." And so then I pulled up, otherwise she would have fallen. And then she took me into the camp itself. Around then we saw the tremendous heaps of bodies, tremendous heaps of shoes and spectacles and other things.
Reverend Hartman, we heard so much about the people in the camps who, after their liberation, either wholeheartedly embraced observant Judaism and thanked God, or after having gone into the camps religious, came out blaming God and asking, "Where have you been, God?" At that time, have you had survivors talk to you about that? Have you had any such experiences in the camp?
I don't think they asked me very much that particular question. I think they concentrated on asking, did the world know about it? Did you do anything about it? I said, no, we didn't. I never heard of the Belsen, never heard of anything else about that time. I said, we've just got to try to help you now. You remained alive under the Nazis, under the SS. Try to remain alive under us whilst we bring in more and more hospitalisation and medical help. I remember some of the people there cried to me, there's a Polish historian, save him. He will be able to tell the world what we went through. Well, the typhus was raging and I was no hero. I wouldn't go in. I said to the doctors, will you go in? She said, no, we don't. We also find difficulty in reconciling us with typhus. So I said, anyhow, pardon me. I was inoculated when I went overseas. So they powdered me, I think it was the DDT, from head to foot. And I took a little can of mixed fruits and a spoon. And I saw two people there. One was the Polish historian and one was a young lady. And I fed them. And I said, try to keep alive under us whilst the British Army organises itself to bring in help. Well, they did what they could. Then I was very fortunate in being able to contact the Canadian Royal Air Force a few miles from Belsen. And when I spoke to the medical officer, went to the commanding officer and to the men there, they offered all their rations for 2 or 3 days.
Reverend Hartman, you will have met and spoken to many, if not most, of the Jewish inmates at the time, and we know all about these almost unspeakable things that you saw. But can you recall any bright moments during your stay?
The bright moments came a little later.
We've already heard the Hatikva from those days, the Song of Hope, but do you remember any particularly nice or even happy anecdotes? Maybe that illustrates people's aspirations or hopes or plans.
It's impossible. I'd never seen this before. I hadn't been prepared for it. My mind was going around in circles, so I thought something with a hope. I found out many of them were Shulman HaTzair, Zionists, Bnei Akiva. When I walked to I took them to the very end of the camp, and I found a sergeant who was sympathetically inclined towards me, and we got them over the fence, and eventually they brought in to me jars of mixed fruit and sweet things that the people enjoyed.
The Tamar Yonah Show.
Tamar, she's sassy.
She's smart.
She's funny.
But she's also a real Jewish mother.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tamar Yonah. And yes, I can be all of those things, but at Israel News Talk Radio, I'm here to bring you the news stories and guests that you may not hear anywhere else. Join me live on air Sundays, Mondays, and Tuesdays for the most unique and bold talk radio in Israel.
The Tamar Yonah Show.
Shalom, I'm Leah Aharoni. Join me on my show, News from the Torah. Each Sunday, we'll use the weekly Torah portion as a prism for understanding the news today. Listen to News from the Torah to gain clarity about the times we're living in and to understand your own spiritual path in the process. News from the Torah, every Sunday on Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
These two guys you talked about, they came from outside into the camp?
No, they were inmates. See, I knew nothing at all about the philosophy of Jabotinsky, except that I saw him at that mass meeting when he told me, he said, the Jewish people of England must arouse their leaders to dump the Jews of Poland on the shores of Palestine before it was too late. Then I learned about the philosophy of Jabotinsky, that is a hod the hadar, to keep themselves clean, keep themselves fit. And when the liberation took place, they organized themselves, these two. They did exercises and all sorts of things.
They wanted to keep fit.
It's a miracle how some of them did keep fit.
Now, what about children? Were there any unattached?
There were plenty of children. I had nothing to do with that side of it. The association I had, there was a famous doctor, Gisela Perl, from Hungary, I think it was. And she was a baby's doctor. She thinks things have never been written about. It's very difficult for me. I can only tell things that I saw and what I experienced. The main books pertaining to Belsen left out the sex business. When the boys and the soldiers and others gave them chocolates and whatever, the girl has been bereft of human kindness. And naturally, they agree to sex. Not the soldiers, but some of the people themselves.
Uh-huh.
Several girls became pregnant. Now, this Gisela Perl had said, I can't let them allow them. I must abort. But I can't allow them to have children. I said to Gisela, I said, you're under British rule now, and it's considered murder. She said, I don't care. Anyhow, she aborted many of them. And that helped a great deal.
Initially, you were the only Jewish religious leader there. And I would imagine that to minister to so many people and in their particular condition, that must have been an almost impossible task. Were you joined by other rabbis later?
But I begged of London to send me more. Yeah, later on, yes. They sent four.
Uh-huh.
Many weeks later.
We know that after the liberation, thousands died from overeating and from their diseases. Did you have to conduct any funeral services?
Oh, yeah, of course. The first pit consisted of about 5,000 bodies. The other one was 8,000 bodies. And if you go to Belsen, you'll see the mound of here lie buried 8,000, here lie buried 3,000. It's the only sign that it's a cemetery. You wouldn't believe it was a cemetery now.
Have you been back there?
Yes, I've been back.
And how long did you stay at the camp?
I stayed there 2 months, with a week of leave.
Was it just too overwhelming to stay there any longer?
Yes. Oh, yes. My senior chaplain came over one day, before we destroyed the camp, and he said at headquarters, Leslie's going mad. Get Hardman out. I said, Harry, come and have a look. There's one filthy hut there. When he saw what he saw, he said, you better stay. It wasn't easy.
I'm sure it wasn't easy.
It wasn't easy.
I know that among the SS camp guards, the commandant, Joseph Kramer, He was known as the Beast of Belsen. He was caught and sentenced to death. Did you see, meet, or even talk to any of the perpetrators?
I didn't see him personally, but I saw the other SS. I saw Irma Grazer, the woman SS woman.
Oh, she was the most terrible of all.
The most vicious-looking woman I've ever seen.
Did you speak to any of them?
No, no. What could I say?
How come that these camp guards and Irma Grazer that you saw was walking around when you were there and wasn't under lock and key? Locked up?
Yeah, if I remember rightly, they didn't disarm them at the beginning. See, I had nothing to do with the prisoners, and I was totally interested in doing what I could for the inmates.
The guard, weren't they meant to carry the bodies and load them on the truck?
Yes. We dug the pits, and they dragged the bodies at the edge, and then they threw them down to the bottom of the pit. When I keep crying and asking for a little more reverence, they're the fellows of the dead. They said, Padre, typhus is raging. We've got to get these bodies underground as quickly as possible, otherwise we'll be affected.
Now, how old were you at the time?
I'm 93 now, just under 30, I suppose.
Last but not least, among the several honours that were bestowed on you is one from the BBC and also, I believe, the Simon Wiesenthal Museum of Tolerance. But you must be very proud to have been made a member of the British Empire. That is the MBE, letters which you can always wear behind your name. Did you go to Buckingham Palace to get it from the Queen?
Yes.
Do you remember what she said to you?
She said, you must have worked hard. It must have been hard work. I said it was. That's all.
That's all she said?
Yes. She had about 50 or 60 people to decorate, and she's told how many words she had to speak to them. When she put her hand out to me to say goodbye, that's a sign I've got to stand back, salute, and walk away.
Well, Captain Leslie Hardman, MBE, you recently had your 93rd birthday, and I wish you belatedly at Mea Ve'ezrim, and thank you for taking time and energy to be my guest today. Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. God bless.
Rabbi Leslie Hardman died on the 7th of October, 2008, aged 95. May his memory serve as a blessing. It is difficult for anyone who has not himself experienced or witnessed the conditions in such a camp to really understand it. So it's almost impossible for me to try to understand the tremendous strength and willpower required to want to stay alive under those conditions, apart from the physical ability. Thank God we have today many camp survivors among us here in Israel and elsewhere in the world. So if you know of any, approach them, press them to hear their stories so that you can pass them on to the next generation. Because all the pictures in the world can only give us an idea. Today's main feature is an account of cold-blooded, premeditated cruelty to innocent human beings, not carried out by psychopathic or deranged individuals, or as a fetish for personal gratification, no, but by 22 men and one woman, highly educated members of a profession that is dedicated to the welfare of their patients, who, in having sworn the Hippocratic Oath, pledged to keep them from harm and injustice. And now I shall play a recording made some years ago when I had as my guest a very special lady who's been honored numerous times for her work, including commendations from Presidents Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, as well as from Vice President Al Gore and the State of Israel. She is Vivian Spitz, who was the youngest court reporter at the Nuremberg trials of war criminals. She died in 2014, but her harrowing account lives on. In her book Doctors from Hell, she describes, and I quote from the introduction, the perverse degradation of German medicine and the demonic human experimentations and murder of thousands of innocent people by willing German doctors, end of quote. All that in the name of progress, the so-called furtherance of genetic knowledge, scientific research, and patriotism. Her account is not for the squeamish. It's a chilling story of human depravity and ultimate justice. The book includes transcripts from the trial that have not been easily available to the general public so far, and also previously unpublished photographs used in evidence at the trial. Vivian Spitz reported verbatim the words that came from the mouth of the perpetrators and the victims who survived these heinous experiments. Vivian Spitz, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
You were a freelance court reporter in Detroit when you heard of the impending trials of the major Nazi war criminals in Nuremberg, Germany, and the need for reporters there who have your skill. You applied, passed the shorthand tests, were selected, and then what happened?
Well, then, this was at the end of the war in May 1945, but before the end, the four countries, Russia, the United States, France, Great Britain, they were putting together all of the evidence for these trials, and they started looking for the people, the attorneys, the judges, the linguists, the reporters, who would be working on the trials. And so, when the War Department recruited me in Detroit, I was only 20 years old. I was 1 year too young. And so, therefore, I passed all of the tests, but they told me I had to wait until I was 21 before I could go.
So you were sitting at home for a while then?
Yes, I was. In the meantime, they had recruited their team of six reporters to report Hermann Göring's trial, the major Nazi leader's trial.
Yeah.
And I had to wait until I was 21. But that was at the end of Göring's trial, when the 12 subsequent trials were tried then by only the United States in military tribunals.
There were a number of subsequent trials, of which one is the subject of your book.
That's correct. That's the first trial.
Verbatim recording of court and parliamentary proceedings is a very strenuous job, and you were so young. I watched these reporters in the British Parliament where they changed over every 15 or 20 minutes. How long did you have to sit at any one time?
We sat at 15-minute turns, and it would change from time to time. It might be as long as half-hour turns.
Really? Did you have one of those specialized punch tape machines or take it all down in shorthand?
No, I was a Greg shorthand writer, but I had to pass the same high-speed shorthand examination that the machine writers, we call them. At 200 words per minute, I have gone on to pass 260 words per minute.
Wow.
In a time where feelings have become fact, where rational thought and common sense has disappeared, one man stands above it all.
I'm Howie Sobiker, your political hitman.
Political Hitman airs every Tuesday at 11:59 p.m. North American time, 7 a.m. Israeli time, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
Are you interested in transforming your life, drawing closer to the Creator, and uncovering the deeper meanings and hidden treasures in the Hebrew Bible?
Then join me, Rav Yitzhak Michelson.
And me, William Hall.
On the Science of Kabbalah, where we are seeking to narrow the gap between what we understand of our physical and spiritual worlds. So make sure to tune in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
I have gone on to pass 260 words per minute.
Wow. Do you ever get cramp in your hands?
Never. I never did.
Oh, well, that's fortunate. You were presumably under U.S. military discipline. Did you wear a uniform?
Oh, no. No, we were civilian employees, but subject to military discipline. I was a contract court reporter of the United States War Department.
We are talking here about the late 1946, is that right?
Yes, November 1946, the doctor's trial started.
As you said, you missed a major trial of the German government with people like Ribbentrop and Göring and all the various people. And then you did doctor's trials. Did you work on all of the subsequent trials?
No. Well, I went in and out of several, the Gestapo trial, for example, but not during the doctor's trial.
No, of course. Now, I want to particularly talk about the trial of the doctors.
Yes.
Had you any idea what to expect before that trial unfolded?
I did not. We did not have television at that time, but I was seeing the movie tone newsreels in the movie theaters about the atrocities as they were revealed upon liberation of the camp. And that was the only kind of orientation that I had. I was so horrified, and to think that doctors were capable of this, that I needed to go to Germany.
I understand. Tell me about your feelings when you first entered the courtroom where these monsters were tried.
Well, it was a huge courtroom. The Palace of Justice had been badly bombed and damaged, but was rebuilt for these trials, restored, remodeled, and so the first day, it was winter time. We had no heat, no heat anywhere except in fireplaces all the time I was there. So I wore my winter coat in November to the courtroom doors and put my coat on a chair outside the door. And the American military officer opened one door of the two doors for me after I showed him my security pass, and I walked into this courtroom. Straight ahead were the four American judges on the bench. To my immediate left were the American MPs behind the prisoner's dock. Then the prisoners, two rows of the doctors and medical assistants. On my right were prosecutors, the American prosecutors, Brigadier General Telford Taylor and his staff.
And you looked at these prisoners.
I walked straight up to the reporter's desk attached to the front of the judge's desk. It was a very long desk. Mm-hmm. And I turned around and sat down. It was not time for me to start writing yet, by maybe a minute. So I scanned all of the doctors in the second row, and then I, from right to left, and then I scanned the first row from right to left. None of the doctors paid attention to me particularly until I got to the number one defendant, who was Dr. Karl Rundt, Hitler's personal physician, and the chief architect of this entire program. Experimentation.
You published a book earlier this year called Doctors from Hell, and I'll give details at the end of the program, so listeners, if you want the details, I suggest you have a pen and paper ready. In the book, besides actual transcript, which gives some insight into the mind of the perpetrators, you describe many of the experiments, at least a dozen, which involved many different procedures. Can you list them for our listeners, or at least some of them?
Oh, yes. I would want to. There were 12 major experiments that were charged. The first was high altitude. And they're all concentration camp inmates. These victims were locked in airtight, ball-shaped compartments, and then the pressure was altered to simulate high-altitude atmospheric conditions up to 68,900 feet without oxygen. These victims were Russian and Polish Jews who were turned professional criminals because they had been condemned for racial shame consisting of marriage or intercourse between non-Aryans and Aryans.
That was according to the Nuremberg Laws of 1934, I think.
Yes, that's correct. The second experiment, and I'll do these briefly, freezing.
First one was for the German Air Force, was it?
Yes, Yes.
Now freezing.
Well, the second one was freezing. And this also had to do with the German pilots who were shot down in the freezing water. These experiments were conducted to test the most effective means of heating severely chilled or frozen people. These victims were placed in long, narrow tanks of ice water for up to 3 hours, at which point death occurred. Well, by keeping them outdoors naked, 9 to 14 hours in sub-freezing temperatures.
These prisoners on whom these experiments were carried out, they didn't pass out?
Oh, yes, they did. They died. Not all of them died, but they were frozen to unconsciousness, and then rewarming of those who did not die was most effective by very hot baths. Then Heinrich Himmler, chief of the Gestapo, who committed suicide after his capture by the British and therefore was never tried, ordered rewarming by naked women. 4 gypsy prostitutes, prisoners, were produced from Ravensbrück camp, and the chilled to unconsciousness naked male victim was placed between 2 naked women, indicating the obscene sickness of Himmler and his doctors.
It is unbelievable stuff. Now,
yeah.
I take it that all the defendants were in court together every day, and you saw them every day. What was the closest you ever got to them?
Well, within 2 feet. Karl Brandt, when I first entered that courtroom and looked at him, his eyes were boring into my eyes with such evil. He was the only doctor who looked at me that it sent a chill down my spine. And the prosecutor, General Taylor, noticed it, and he said later he thought it was because I was tall, blonde, and blue-eyed. His ideal Aryan.
I see, yes, and, of course.
Yes, and I had to walk by him, within 2 feet of him, every 15 minutes that I was in and out of the courtroom, 5 or 6 times a day.
He sat at the end of the row, and he was closest to you as you left.
Yes, that's right. I could touch him.
Really? Now, being so close to those mass murderers who actually swore the Hippocratic Oath to only do good, how did that make you feel?
Of course, Hitler did away with the Hippocratic Oath and changed everything in that regard. But it made me terrified of these men. They were all resentful. And in the book, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has cooperated with me and at my request provided me with headshots of every one of these 20 doctors and 3 medical assistants, so that you can look right into their eyes in those headshots and see the evil, the arrogance, the resentment.
And most of those are reproduced in your book.
Every one.
Yes. I have the book here, and it makes horrific reading. And when evidence was heard about a particular doctor, did you observe his reactions, his body language, for instance?
Just an almost stoical arrogance. And when they testified that they were involved in something noble for the fatherland, in developing the pure 1,000-year right, perfect race, and eliminating all of the people they considered subcultures, the Jews, the Gypsies, the Slavs, and there were not only 6 million Jews slaughtered, but there were millions of non-Jews who were sucked into this vortex. Dachau concentration camp.
That's near Munich.
Yes, near Munich was where they concentrated all of the religious, the Catholic priests, mostly Polish Catholic priests, and Protestant ministers, and I think several Muslims. They had categories of all of these people who were to be exterminated.
Is that not the place where they made them stand early in the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, for many hours?
Yes. with bare feet on ice on the snow. The cruelty and bestiality is unbelievable.
There were many witnesses, survivors of these horrendous experiments by one or another of these murderers. Were all these witnesses able to give their testimony calmly, rationally, and with self-control?
Pretty much they did. They were able to handle their testimony with dignity, with seriousness, sometimes going into tears. The seawater experiments were conducted on German, Czech, and Polish gypsies who were deprived of food and given only yellow, brackish seawater for days, resulting in excruciating pain and eventually, in most cases, madness. And one of the most dramatic courtroom scenes occurred during my turn in the courtroom when a gypsy man, a small man, Carl Hohlenrainer, assumed the witness stand and was questioned about why he was arrested on 29 May 1944. And then he said, because he was a gypsy of mixed blood. And then the Reich citizenship laws decreed Jews and gypsies cannot become citizens. And the law for the protection of German blood and German honor, dated November 14, 1935, another infamous Nuremberg law, stated a marriage shall furthermore not be contracted if the progeny to be expected from it would endanger the purity of German blood. And when Carl Hohlenrainer was asked by the American prosecutor to stand, take his earphones off, proceed to the defendant's dock, and identify the doctor who performed these experiments on him, who was Dr. Beagelbach, he flew from the witness stand and just seemed like he was flying through the air toward the prisoner's dock with his right arm stretched high, reaching for Dr. Beagelbach, the consulting physician to the German Air Force. Three of our American military policemen rushed from behind the prisoner's dock, grabbed this little man almost in midair, who was bent on delivering his own brand of justice, subduing him just short of his target. He had been able to hide a dagger on his person.
And he went for the doctor with a dagger?
Yes, with a dagger. And, of course, after that, there was very great security about each witness coming into the courtroom because he was determined that he was going to kill that doctor in that courtroom. He had been able to hide that dagger on his person and had been able to almost get to the doctor. But that was the most emotional scene in the courtroom during all the time I was there.
How did that doctor react? Was he indifferent? Was he angry?
Well, no, he was frightened. I mean, he was leaning back away from this man who was coming at him with a knife. He was shocked and frightened.
It's very interesting how these people who did such horrendous things to other people were frightened when someone comes for them.
Yes.
After they had restrained the witness, that gypsy, what happened then? Did he continue with his evidence?
Yes, he did. They brought him back after the judge sentenced him to 90 days.
The judge sentenced him to 90 days? What for?
For contempt of court. And at that time, I was the one who was so shocked. And I had tears coming out of my eyes because of what was happening, you know, with this poor guy who had already suffered all of this horror, all of these experiments. He was made to drink seawater, brackish yellow seawater for days, with no food and nothing else. And then liver punctures were made several times by this doctor.
It's amazing that he survived.
Both of them went mad, frothing at the mouth, just went insane.
Foaming at the mouth. Those who were still alive, most of them, what happened to them?
Most of them, they killed.
The book has lots of transcripts and, of course, your comments and your feelings. And it's a very, very difficult read, but it ought to be read because there are so few people who know what went on.
I am in conversation with Vivian Spitz, who was the youngest court reporter at the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals. And we are talking about the trial of the concentration camp doctors.
Of all the terrific and painful experiments on human beings, two struck me as particularly horrendous. There was the procurement of skeletons of Jews for the Strasbourg University by what was referred to as defleshing. So they took people, defleshed them, and then made them into skeletons for the university students. And the other one that I found so horrendous was the instructions how to preserve severed heads for further examination after the victim had already been, during his lifetime, measured and documented before being killed. And then, of course, also that they took 500 so-called idiots and epileptics, as ever described. They were studied and during their lifetime, and they too were killed and then their brains examined. This is almost impossible to conceive. What experiments stand out in your mind?
Well, I think the bone, muscle, and nerve regeneration and bone transplantation experiments were another that were so horrifying.
Can you describe them, please?
Yes. You know, legs taken off at the hips. And I have captured German film in my book of these experiments. A bin of legs, for example, that was captured. In my book is the testimony of one of the survivors, Karolinska, and I describe how she testified that she was subjected to 6 surgical experiments where she was held down in the bunker by SS men or in the camp hospital, and they slashed her leg, and then they took a hammer and they smashed her leg to break it into 2 or 3 pieces. And then they would take bone out, they would put pieces, slivers of bone in different places, and then heal the leg back up without any sulfa or drugs. And she suffered 6 of these experiments. She was a lucky survivor who came to Nuremberg and testified from the witness stand, and I have her picture on the back of the book. I agree with you on the horrifying thought that they actually selected Jews, killed them, and you never heard such a silence in that courtroom as when they intoned the word defleshed to complete a skeleton collection.
There were also experiments with mustard gas and also with sulfanilamide.
Yes, sulfanilamide.
Yes, that was done on women in a women's camp, Ravensbrück, I think. Done by a woman doctor.
Yes, and she was the only woman doctor. She was Dr. Herta Oberhäuser.
I'm looking at her pictures. Her eyes are stinging.
Yes, yes. Well, the sulfanilamide was the drug to ease the pain, kill infections, and when they performed the surgery, they used sulfanilamide to keep infections from developing.
So they actually caused these people to have wounds and then tried to heal them?
Yes, that's right. And then open them up again, even maybe in another place. She was awful. She was one of the worst.
Of course, we know of the concentration camp guards in Belsen and other places, people like Irma Grese and others. Those women were more cruel than the men.
Oh, yes, they were.
As the trial progressed, it must have taken its toll on you.
Did
you get angry? Did you get depressed or at times feeling that it was all too much for you? Or could you take it in your stride?
Oh, no, I could not. My first weeks in the courtroom, I was just having tears come to my eyes and falling on my reporting pages that I was writing. And I knew I had to get this passion out quickly because I had a job to do, to record verbatim all of this horror, you know, which I want the world to read about. The reporters and the interpreters bonded. We became friends because we were under such tight security where we lived and where we could travel. They helped me get through. They were by 5 to 20 years older than I was.
But you were really a young slip of a girl, weren't you?
Yes, 22 years old.
Yes.
And I had never, ever thought I would be reporting anything like this. And I had to. When I got home, I had a terrible time because I was having nightmares for 3 years. I was always escaping in a tunnel from a concentration camp. And for some reason, I had 4 or 5 little children with me. I was trying to keep them quiet. So the Nazi guard walking back and forth above with his bayoneted rifle along the barbed wire fence would not hear the children. So I thought it must have been I was escaping from the Theresienstadt concentration camp, the camp for the children. Sometimes they would occur, you know, at least once a week, twice a week, for 3 years. And then I finally managed to get control of them until 1987. I was back here in Denver, and by then I was retired from court reporting from my Denver court when there was a German language arts teacher in a high school in my Denver suburb who referred to the Holocaust to her senior students as the Hola Hoax.
I want to come to that subject a little later, if I may. While you were in Nuremberg, how did you combat these feelings that came over you? Did you have any diversions? Did you have distractions, entertainments? How did you keep yourself sane?
That's an important question. The United States government realized what we were suffering through. We had the Non-Commissioned Officers Club, the Red Cross Club, an ice skating rink, swimming pool, a movie theater, where they also showed German comic operas with Germans performing. We congregated in the Grand Hotel, and when I say congregated, we had to be picked up wherever we were assigned living quarters in Germany, in Nuremberg, by an American military vehicle, and taken to the Grand Hotel. The hotel had been repaired, and American and Allied personnel of officer rank were in the hotel. The GIs had their other living quarters, but in the hotel we had our dining rooms, and we would gather there in the cocktail lounge. There was no heat, and if somebody had an electric heater plugged into the wall, then we would try to get as close as we could to that person.
Were there many women there?
Yes, there were. I would say court reporters, about half men, half women.
You were there for a year. What about your home? Was that comfortable?
Initially, I was billeted in a small 2-story, 3-bedroom German house on Bielostrasse with a young British woman and a young French woman. They were clerks in another section of the trials. I eventually, after a couple of months, I was able to move into a huge mansion, number 8 Hebelstrasse, with 2 other American women court reporters. In that mansion, the army also conducted a mess where they had a breakfast prepared and served army style for all of the employees and the people whom they gathered and brought to this house. Then I was able to get into wherever everybody wanted to live, which was the Grand Hotel, because of the tight security. And I had a very nice room across the bathroom with another American woman court reporter from Nebraska. And they were very nice rooms. And the hotel was a beautiful old grand hotel. And we had our food there. They had a ballroom where they brought in the German musicians, musicians from other countries, Denmark, and for entertainment.
So they made sure that you had some distraction, that you could take your mind off the court proceedings.
That's correct. And we were also able to get orders, military orders, travel by military buses to Prague, Czechoslovakia, Brussels, Holland. When we had long periods, by long, I mean 4 days for a little vacation to get away from that courtroom. Oh, but it was always when court was not in session.
You made reference in your book to the fact that it wasn't so safe in Nuremberg after the war. I thought that once we had occupied the place, it was an American occupation zone, that everything was under control. But you say that there were still problems.
Oh, many problems.
But what I wanted to know, what was it like in Nuremberg? There were some attacks, some snipers. That's what interests me, because it was supposed to be the end of the war, finished.
No, it was a situation minimally like today in Iraq. Even up to 19 months after the end of the war, there were still Nazi terrorists hiding in the rubble, Nuremberg, which was totally bombed down. And under the ancient, beautiful medieval walled city, there were catacombs. And these Nazi terrorists were still hiding in those catacombs, coming out at night, shooting anybody on the street who even looked like an American or Allied person, civilian or military. While I lived in the Grand Hotel, one afternoon when I was getting ready to go down from my fourth floor room to the dining room, I heard and felt an enormous vibration and explosion. I knew the hotel had been bombed. Everyone fleeing out onto the street. Two Nazi fanatics had come out from under the wall city, crossed the street, and thrown a bomb through the big glass windows into the dining room of the Grand Hotel, crowded.
19 months after the end of the war. So that part of Germany must have been a hotbed of Nazism, because I happened in 1945 and 6 and 7, I was stationed with British forces in the north of Germany doing certain work, and we didn't hear of anything like that. Let me get back to the trial. During the final statements of the accused before sentencing, did any of them express remorse, or what was their general tone?
No, they did not. Not one of them expressed any kind of remorse at all. They were proud of what they're doing, or they denied on the witness stand that they had ordered these experiments until they were confronted with documents that showed their signatures. They must not have remembered that. They were in denial for everything.
Having seen the whole trial, were you disappointed that only 7 of them were sentenced to death and that 7 were even acquitted?
Yes. I was disappointed that only 7 were sentenced to death. And I was shocked that 7 were acquitted. I felt that maybe 3 or 4 of them could have been acquitted, but not 7. But you have to realize that the world was watching. And there were press corps there from approximately 20 countries covering these trials. And they were waiting to see if the American judges had found them all guilty and sentenced them to death. The world would have felt that it was not a fair trial. And I felt that our judges were leaning over backwards trying to show the world that this was not a trial of vengeance, but a trial of justice over evil.
In later years, did you learn what happened to those who were sentenced to life imprisonment? Were they released eventually, as they usually do, or what happened to them? Are you aware of any?
I know that those who were sent outside of Hess, you know, the major Nazi...
I actually meant the doctors.
No, the doctors, they were sentenced to prison, but they never served out all of their periods in prison. Eventually, they were released by one of the American officers in charge of the U.S. sector in Germany. I could never understand that either.
Nor can I. Today you are lecturing internationally on the subject that you've so painfully learned. How do your audiences react?
You know, when I finish my talks, I give a PowerPoint presentation of approximately 38 slides of mostly captured German film, and I just spoke to 1,700 people in Phoenix at a convention, and I was told that everybody in the audience had tears. This is the usual reaction.
Well, of course, as I said earlier, the people today have no idea. It's a long time ago, and people really didn't read about that. At best, they knew maybe who Hitler was, but not a great deal more. And with all the pages of testimony and the admissions by the perpetrators themselves when they were, as you say, confronted with the documents, how do you explain Holocaust denial?
These people are hate groups. They hate all Jews, they hate all blacks in this country, all Catholics. It is a venomous organization. I mean, we have the skinheads in the United States, the German and others who join them, groups who become killers. And we've had several terrible cases in Colorado.
Yeah,
where they shave their heads to identify themselves.
How do you explain the fact that with all the evidence that has been published and that we know about, and films and slides and witness testimonies, that there are people who say, as you said, it was a hoax, a Holocaust hoax?
Yes, I've been confronted seriously twice by the largest group in the United States called the Institute for Historical Review, based in Newport Beach, California. And I had to be taken off the podium at the end of the talk at the Long Beach, California Hilton Hotel by an armed security guard who had to rush me off of the podium, out the door, into the basement of the hotel for security, because this group was in the hotel and demanding that they be allowed to come in when the hotel had extra security and could not get them out. I also was confronted in Colorado by this group, and the one man sat through my entire talk, saw the slides, and they claimed that all of these trials were stage shows produced by the four countries, that they were sham trials, they were not real, and all of the photographs were fake and created.
I personally believe that they don't really believe that themselves, but that it fits into their philosophy and in their teaching. And I think they're using that as simply as a tool.
I think you're correct.
Now, finally, I would be remiss if I wouldn't mention that for 10 years in the 70s and 80s, you were chief reporter in the U.S. House of Representatives, and you also recorded various presidents' State of the Union addresses. Which president's speeches did you record?
by recorded presidents Richard Nixon, President Gerald Ford, President Jimmy Carter, and President Ronald Reagan.
Wow. You also took down the addresses to Congress by visiting foreign heads of state and other notable events. Who was the most difficult speaker to understand and to follow?
We had a leader from one of the African countries, a very small country. I do not remember the name, and I had a difficulty understanding him. He was later, shortly thereafter, assassinated. But the other leaders, even with their accents, they spoke good English. I could understand them. The one leader that I felt so impressed by was President Anwar Sadat of Egypt. In his first visit to the United States of any Arab nation, I reported also Yitzhak Rabin of Israel. I was so impressed with him.
Have you ever been to Israel?
Yes, I have.
Did you speak here?
No, I didn't. I was on a Catholic pilgrimage. With my church and another church. We had 24 of us in 1986. And I also was invited to go to the Knesset to visit with the reporters there. But instead, I chose to go to Hadassah Hospital. I've done a lot of foreign travel. My trip to Israel was the trip that I felt was the most important in my life. As a result of the trials and of that trip, my heart has been with the Jews ever since.
Well, that's very nice to hear. Do you intend to come again and maybe on a speaking tour?
Well, I haven't been invited. I am now 81, and I do have an extensive speaking commitment right now. Many synagogues in this country. And as long as I can travel.
Absolutely. It's wonderful that you are still fit enough to do all that. Vivian, thanks for having so vividly related your experiences. Now, your book, Doctors from Hell, subtitled A Horrific Account of Nazi Experiments on Humans, the book was published by Sentinel Publications of Boulder, Colorado, and I'll give you a zip code. It's 80302. And an important number for the book, if you want it, the ISBN number is 1-59181-032-9. Now, don't worry if you didn't copy it all down. You can hear the whole program on demand on our website, which is www.israelnationalradio.com. You would obviously know that, because otherwise you couldn't hear us. And then you scroll down to Walter's World. Vivian Spitz, it was enlightening to have had you on the program. Thank you. And with your permission, I want to finish with one sentence from another book. It's by Bernice Rubens, called The Brothers. In the whole history of murdering men among all its victimized peoples, there has never been a more accomplished, a more ingenious, a more terrible cavalcade of cruelty. Not much has changed. When men are still capable of acting like animals and lynch their fellow humans,
as Palestinian Arabs have done from time to time. And so I end this special program for this year's International Holocaust Remembrance Day. If you have any thoughts about the program, please write to Walter at Israel News Talk Radio, one word, .com, where you will always get my personal reply, or write your comment on the appropriate place on the Walter Bingham file page. Until the next program, this is Walter Bingham wishing you a safe week, and please follow the instructions to keep clear of COVID-19, and most importantly, please visit your elderly neighbor. The lockdowns and restrictions are particularly hard on the elderly, who may be hesitant to go out and then have problems in getting food supplies online in some countries. So please make the effort. Thank you. Goodbye.
Can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candle lighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Howdy, this is Rita from League City, Texas, now living in Israel. And though my heart may have belonged to Texas, it now belongs to Israel and all the fantastic show hosts at Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Michael Solomon from Kiryat Arba, Israel. And why do I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio? Because I love listening to the interesting interviews they do and their news reporting that most other media sources don't cover.
Hey, this is Nicole Eko from Malmo, Sweden. It gets pretty cold here in Sweden, so I love cuddling up with a warm cup of tea while I listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Frank Karras from Tennessee. Me and my dog Buster really love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.